Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. Today, I'm delighted to be talking to the distinguished writer Thomas Pakenham, most famous for his best-selling books on the Boer War, the Scramble for Africa, and Meetings with Remarkable Trees. He's just written a new book about trees called The Tree Hunters, which is about the extraordinary men who set out from Britain across the world to bring back seeds for extraordinary trees in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. And he begins by talking about the origins of the arboretum.
In your book, you talk about the invention of the arboretum, and that's it's a 17th century thing, is that right?
Well, the extraordinary thing about John Evelyn's great book on silver, he has a collection of exotic trees himself. He talks about other famous ancient trees, but he lists trees which are now important veterans in Britain and all over the world. He doesn't use the word arboretum that I can find,
right.
But he does use the word acerretum, the maple collection, the quercetum, the oak collection. And it's extraordinary that these invented additional words appear in his... I can't explain it, really. I wonder whether arboretum has been somehow sort of slipped out of the copy.
I see.
But basically, the first time I found it used in print was in printed map of Kew Gardens of 17... It's in my text,
yeah.
Like 1760
yeah.
Or 1770, I can't remember. And I'm not even certain that that wasn't a more modern label attached to the map. In other words, it wasn't necessarily the first. It may not have been the first. After that, I found it used in 1798 in Ireland, in Dublin.
Right.
And in each case, it clearly hadn't been coined in Ireland. It was obviously in currency.
I see.
So it could really just... The only certain thing is it was a late 18th century concept, a collection arranged in a certain way for science or pleasure or both.
Yeah. And so it leads to this fashion for arboreta, if that's the right word, and then you concentrate on this collection of tree hunters from John Tradescant, would you say?
Tradescant would be the first of the tree hunters in my story, yes.
Which is what sort of date?
Tradescant, the two of them.
Yeah.
But the one who went to Russia was the elder one, and he's supposed to have collected various European trees we didn't have, like the larch, but I don't think that's even certain. And then the son went to America and brought back the swamp cypress, the tulip tree, and really important American East Coast trees.
And when is this?
About the time of the publication of Silver. The Tradescants would be 1630. When was Charles I executed?
1649. 1649.
Executed.
Yeah.
Well, the Tradescants, father and son, were both royal gardeners before, obviously,
right.
The Civil War. So they are in the 1630s and 40s.
Right. And then your reason for choosing these all very interesting men, John Bannister, Joseph Banks, David Douglas, what made you select them as opposed to any other tree hunters? Or they are the greatest?
I think I chose to highlight people for whom there were some reasonable sources. For whatever reason, we kept... Somebody had written an account of their trip or listed the trees they collected. So it was always a search for sources was always difficult. And I mean, Bishop Compton, who played quite a part in my story, didn't write any letters that I heard of or that it was... A lot of it was reports in magazines. Some of them were in the 19th century magazines reporting on what was being done 100 years earlier. I mean, Loudon did a lot of historical research.
And it's they're all British. That's because you chose them all, because actually the remarkable ones were all British. It was a British thing, was it?
If you think of the Quaker who followed Bishop Compton in the early 18th century, was made a member of the Royal Society. You know, what's his name? His name escapes me. Anyway, the Quaker tree collector, who has a whole chapter to himself, you'll see it there.
Yeah.
He organised an American farmer to be his collector. And he was American, so he wasn't sent out from England to collect. He was an American farmer who was hired by the Quaker. But I think, trying to think of any other exception to the fact they're all English.
Well, so it just reflects the great power of Britain at the time.
He was called John Bartram, the American farmer.
And we've just been talking about it, but they...
When I say English, British, including Scottish, obviously.
Yeah. They lead these extraordinary lives, tree hunters, and first of all, it's incredibly dangerous, isn't it, being a tree hunter?
There are dangers of every kind, really, and no maps. And they went to places which had never been explored. I mean, think of David Douglas as late as 1830, plodding around these jungles of western, what now is Oregon, California, only some terrifying Indians. I mean, no administration, no... In fact, it was no man's land because nobody had decided whose country would even... The Americans hadn't even got the border defined between Mexico and America. So they were giants, these collectors, really. They were all daredevils.
Yeah. And obviously they didn't know what they were going to find when they went there, but they knew that these areas would be extremely fertile hunting grounds, is that correct?
But they would go back a second time, and for example, you mentioned the first of the Tredescans in the early 17th century, went three times to America, separate trips. I suppose there was quite a good sort of public transport across to America, but not only to the big ports in the East Coast and the beginnings of... When was he given Pennsylvania?
I couldn't swear to it, but I imagine that's that late... Mm-hmm. Late 17th, early 18th?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Anyway, the East Coast would have had a fairly good shipping service because people were emigrating, weren't they? What is absolutely certain is the tree hunters risked their lives and sometimes lost them.
And could you tell that one is gored to death by a wild bull?
Who?
Isn't one gored to death by
That's
a
David
wild...
That's David Douglas.
Yes, yeah. Who described that scene.
He might have been murdered first. Right. You have to read carefully. I think I now believe he wasn't murdered. I'll tell you why. Simply because the evidence of his little dog, Billy, who was found sitting guarding his master's knapsack after the body was discovered. If he'd really been murdered, imagine him shouting, shrieking, and then being pushed into this bull pit. His dog wouldn't have sat there. For the defence, I would call the dog.
Right. I mean, it's a thankless task. They're paid a pittance, aren't they, the tree hunters?
Oh, 100 a year, nothing. A minimum wage. But they were prepared to do that. Let's say they were daredevils and adventurers. Adventurers don't necessarily try and make money.
Yeah.
And David Douglas was... His first expedition was to East Coast America, where he was really treated... already very well indeed by these rather grand American families. He wasn't treated like a sort of British scum or anything. No, when they arrived, while they were in the civilized place, they were quite well treated.
And you also paint a very good picture of what's going on back here. It becomes incredibly fashionable, particularly among the grand. So there's a chapter about the Dukes, Marlborough, Bedford, Devonshire.
Yes.
And they're building arboretums on a massive scale.
On a massive scale. And, of course, because their houses are being built on a massive scale, too. I mean, think of the size of Chatsworth.
Yeah.
But, it bursts into life in that early 19th century way with competition from Dukes to be the first to have this plant or that plant. But... when I talk about John Claudius Loudon as the high priest, his magazine, The Gardener's Magazine, was enormously influential because it was reporting everything going on in this world in a very very well written, very exciting, and I mean Douglas's journeys would have all been described in the, as soon as he came back, he would be, the magazine would be trying to get his story. But before 1825, the war was going on, things obviously quite different. If you think of the war ended in 1815, but yeah. 10 years later, Loudon began his magazine, which is a great financial success as well as ever. And he was writing a magazine for gardeners as well as grandees.
Yeah.
And no one had tried that before. There was no 18th century magazine like that.
And there are, it's not just dukes. You talk about these great arboretums at Sheffield and Nottingham and Derby. But there's a rather sad end to your book. A lot of those are now gone, is that right? Why did they go?
I'm afraid it's back to the same thing, which is that it needs constant management, an arboretum. Plants die with amazing speed, and they've got to be replaced. Rare plants are perhaps more, because they're rare, there may be a reason for that being rare, because they're more delicate, more difficult to grow. And always you need enthusiasts. And I think in public gardens, that they wouldn't have that. Anyway, slowly the only one that Loudon himself had designed, Derby, gradually became just a public park, which it is now.
So you go back to most of these, and some of them are in a sad state, but the great triumph is Westonbirt, is that right? And why has that survived so well?
They were just so bloody rich, and just nothing could stop them. It's very interesting there's no map of Westonbirt. That tells me something. They didn't want the public to go there. They didn't want other people to share that sort of excitement. And there were two generations of them, father and son, both enormously rich. And the son was rather more or less, I think, reclusive. The father must have been really a recluse. But imagine these great palaces he built.
One of them inherits £1 million, is that right?
Which in our money is about 100 million.
Unbelievable, yeah.
The equivalent would be a modern billionaire, wouldn't it, really?
And that Westonbirt survived because it's been kept going and is now the National Arboretum.
It was a miracle that it survived as an arboretum and didn't become a public park or something. But I mean, the tragedy of Loudon's life was he wanted Hyde Park to be an arboretum. He wanted St. James's Park to be an arboretum. He wanted public parks to have an educational function and also an exciting story, if you like, a narrative, plants being discovered. And it didn't happen. And the only actual... he was invited to do one for Birmingham, which would be really... must have been a big commission. And then they didn't do it as he wanted it, with a new glass house like the Palm House in Kew.
Yeah.
And he was so fed up. He's rather sort of tricky man, Loudon. Instead of biting his lip and accepting the fact they didn't have the money to build, he just said, I don't want to know anything more. I don't want my name to be linked to it. And then he did Derby, and that was a great success, but only in Derby. But people did come and see it, and the designer of Central Park in America came to Derby to look at it. But I don't think Central Park is an arboretum.
No, I don't think so.
No.
And in terms of how the trips were planned, so they went to America and China and Japan, but obviously it was done, there wasn't any great overarching plan. It was go somewhere which hasn't been visited before, is that right?
Well, I think you could say that they would have gone to China long before if they'd been allowed to. And the... Do you remember the Lord McCartney?
Yes.
McCartney and his mission to the Emperor of China.
Yeah.
And all that money was put up by the British government because trade with China was so important to get it going. And it was going to actually help the East India Company, but obviously that was sponsored by the government. And they sent two warships. The cost of that took a three-year trip. I mean, what would be the cost? Quite considerable.
Tens of millions, yeah.
And the end of it all was a slap in the face from the emperor.
Oh, yes, very good, that scene.
But one single plant out of all that. And yesterday I was in a garden in a county, Kildare, and there was a beautiful, beautiful rose, a stunningly beautiful rose, and it's evergreen. It's the McCartney rose.
Funny.
The one thing they brought back.
How funny.
And I read that it wouldn't survive in the Irish winter, and that it was only for sort of warmer places. But there, it's growing in Kildare, quite a long way from the sea. It's called Brachiata.
Because that's the other thing, is that there were these great daredevils crossing the world, bringing back these trees, and they weren't sure that they would grow here.
Oh, yeah, no idea whether they would. But, I mean, basically, the simple way of looking at it is this. Altitude cancels out latitude. If you're in China at latitude 26, you're in the tropics.
Yeah.
Or subtropics, I think the tropics start about that. It's southern China. But if you're in southern China at 3,000 meters, 10,000 feet, that brings you the equivalent of latitude 53, which is us
right
here.
Yes.
The two, one is set against the other. So they would know what their altitudes were when they were collecting. They would have had what's the instrument you meant?
Altimeter.
Well, anyway,
yes.
They knew certainly roughly what altitude they were collecting at.
Yeah.
And when we were there in 1993 and 95, we would always look at the height before we would start collecting.
Right.
So we knew that above that, we were fairly safe.
Because you are a significant tree hunter yourself, Thomas, and you've been to China and Tibet in order to gather trees, particularly for this arboretum, but generally for Talinani, is that right?
I've done five tree hunting expeditions, the first two, China, Tibet, and then with the Rosses, with Ali and Brendan, we went to Outer Mongolia, and that was quite fun, but hopeless from the point of view of collecting, because although we had the good latitude, we were quite 35 or something, or maybe even, no, I think it probably nearer 40 latitude, we were, and we were fairly high. The winter is so severe there that the plants they can't adapt to our winter here.
Right, I see.
Well, that's a very good place to stop, and thank you so much to Thomas Pakenham for talking about his new marvellous book, The Tree Hunters, on Radio Oldie. Thanks so much.